Do whales sneeze?
I'm not sure, but luckily I've got an amazing whale expert I can call on.
We essentially go out onto a boat, we go out to the sea, we look for whales, we see a whale breathing.
Who will take us through her experiments.
And then as the whale takes a breath, the drone is flown through the snot and will deliberately collect as much snot as possible.
And let us know the answer. How does that sound, Guy?
That would be fun.
Join us on The Conversation's Curious Kids, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB Digital Radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
Welcome to the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Hello, my name's Dan. We've got a huge guest on the show this week, by the way. Tim Peake, the astronaut. He will be here. One of only seven British people to ever have been in space. We'll be talking about life on the International Space Station, what future plans for space travel are, and that includes, by the way, turning the moon into kind of like a motorway service station. It's a brilliantly strange idea. You need to hear more about that. Also, Tim will be telling us about his brand new book, Ask an Astronaut. He'll be on the show in a little bit. Seriously, chatting to a spaceman? It's kind of like life made. We've also got all the other amazing, epic and dangerous things in the universe on the way too. We'll talk about gravity and speed. Also, you can hear about a place in the world that is so deadly, it's got kill in its name. First, let's go into space ourselves with our space cadet friends today. They're on the moon.
Welcome along to the astro adventures of the space cadets.
And sprinkle on the cheese and we're done.
Lovely. Top pizza, mate. We just need to cook it now.
What are you boys up to?
We've made a pizza zingy.
Yeah, we just need to cook it now. Any bright ideas?
Well, what's wrong with the oven?
Oh, we can't use that. We've got tonight's roast chicken cooking in there.
But then why do you need a pizza, Terry?
Pre-dinner snack. Harry likes his pre-dinner snacks.
Yeah, I need to have a pre-dinner snack, especially before chicken. It's something about poultry, you see, Zingy.
No, I don't really see, but I'm trying to understand you. Is that really ham with pineapple?
Ah, the Hawaiian pizza. What a man's greatest achievement.
Yes, quite.
Guys, I've got some seriously bad news.
What is it, Harry?
I think we've nearly run out of cheese.
Is that it? You have me worried.
It is a worry.
Well, no time for it now. Mission Control have just sent a message through. We're off to the moon.
Fantastic.
Yeah, and we can solve our cheese situation.
Oh, Harry, the moon is not actually made of cheese, you know. That's just an absurd myth.
Really? Oh.
The moon's surface is actually comprised of many different chemical compounds, mainly silica-based, which is found in sand, but none of them dairy-based, I'm afraid.
Oh, I'll put my crackers back then. Still, I can't wait to land on the moon. Isn't the Earth's moon the place where humans first landed in space?
Yes. In 1969, man first landed on the moon. American astronauts Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin were the first men to walk on the moon.
One of man's greatest achievements, space travel.
Yeah, it's okay. But let's not go mad and forget the sheer genius of the Hawaiian pizza.
Yes, Harry. But did you know the moon is the Earth's only natural satellite?
What's a natural satellite?
It's a body or object which orbits a larger body, usually a planet. The moon orbits the Earth every 28 days.
Why does the moon look different shapes at different times when I look at it from Earth?
Well, the moon reflects light from the sun, which is why it can appear so bright. But as it orbits around the Earth, different amounts of the sunlit side are visible. This creates the different shapes you can see: full moon, half moon, crescent moon, and so on.
So what's our mission, Zingy?
Mission Control would like us to investigate an old NASA landing site from when man first landed on the moon in 1969 and report back on what it's like today.
Cool! You excited too, RoboWoof?
Hold tight for landing, boys. We're nearly there.
Wow!
I've positioned the ship just a couple of miles from the first landing site of the Eagle craft from the Apollo 11 mission back in 1969. Take RoboWoof out and the investigation pod and bring back some photos of what the site's like today.
Okay, Zingy, no problem.
And remember, keep your spacesuits on at all times. The moon has no atmosphere, so be careful.
The landing site should be just up here. You okay driving, Terry?
Fine, thank you.
It's just the ground's quite dusty and there's craters to watch out for.
I know, I can see them, mate. I'm not you.
Hey. Oh, wow. Terry, can you see that? It's the old landing site. Is that an American flag?
It's a bit battered, but yeah, it is. The Stars and Stripes, the American flag. Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin must have left it here.
You getting photos of all this, Robo-Wolf? I'm getting out and having a look around.
Yeah. Hey, look at these footprints in the moon's surface. They've survived in the dust all these years.
One small step for man, one giant leap for... Robo-Wolf, come back here. We need you to take more photos of the site.
What have you found, boy? Harry, look at what Robo-Wolf's found. It's an old NASA moon buggy. It must have been left here.
Oh, wow. Does it still work?
Harry, it's not going to still work.
You were saying? Mate, there's two of us. We have an investigation pod and now a NASA moon buggy.
Dude, are you thinking what I'm thinking?
I know. The Hawaiian is definitely the most underrated pizza.
No, not that. No, I think we should have a little race.
Oh, yeah, let's do that. Let's start at these footprints, go round the crater over there, and finish at the old American flag.
Sure. I want the NASA moon buggy. It looks speedy.
OK, I'll take the pod. Get lined up. Robo-Wolf, can you start the race, please?
OK, Robo-Wolf. Ready when you are.
Go!
Ah! I'm going to beat you, Harry.
Come on, then. Hey, watch out. We're on the edge of the crater here.
I'm going to win, Harry. This NASA moon buggy is super speedy.
No!
Ah!
Terry! Are you okay, man?
Yeah, I'm fine. Oops, the tyres burst. Probably shouldn't have driven it so fast.
Do you think this is what Zingy had in mind when she said investigate?
I don't know. Hope so. Come on, let's get back to the ship.
Welcome back, boys. How was it?
Oh, Zingy, it was amazing. The flag's still there and the footprints and everything.
Fantastic. NASA will be happy. Sending copies of Robo-Wolf's photographs to Mission Control now.
And Robo-Wolf even found an old moon buggy too.
Incredible, well done.
Yeah, it looked like it was in pretty good nick too.
Yes, all spacecraft and vehicles are built from the highest quality materials. Well, except for my old ship. Spaceship cutbacks, that is. That moon buggy will probably stay in one piece for many more years. Harry, why do you have a moon buggy wheel under your jumper?
Oh, this? It's a souvenir?
Join us next time for more Astro Adventures with the Space Cadets.
You've got loads more Space Cadets adventures for you to catch up on for free on your phone or tablet. Get to iTunes, open up the free Fun Kids app, and you can have a listen at funkidslive.com. We've got a bit of a spacey theme to the show, actually, because a bit later we'll talk space junk with Techno Mum, and in a sec we will have that chat with Tim Peake, an actual astronaut on the show. Firstly, I want to bring things a little bit more down to earth and say a massive thank you. If you have been onto the iTunes podcast store and you've left the show a review, an even bigger thank you if you've been nice enough to leave us 5 stars too, because if you are loving this show, the Fun Kids Science Weekly, that is the best way to let us know and to get in touch. And I mean, really, come on, what more do you want? We've got Tim Peake, an actual spaceman, on the show later. If that's not worth a 5-star review, then I really don't know what is. So yeah, if you want to be like a true hero, just like Tim, get out your phone or your tablet right now, open up the iTunes podcast store, find the Fun Kids Science Weekly and leave us a review. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. We've got a huge guest on this week. He is the first British European Space Agency astronaut, the 7th British person in space as well. Tim Peake, hello, welcome, how are you?
Hello, yeah, I'm very good, thanks.
Perfect. So you've got a brand new book out. It's Ask an Astronaut. So that's what I'm going to do with this chat. I'm just going to ask you any question that I've always wanted to ask a spaceman. Is that okay?
Okay, fire away.
If I was 7 years old and I was an astronaut, what would I need to do to make it happen?
Okay, to make it happen, firstly, it's 7 years old. You need to firstly finish school, get some good qualifications. A scientific background would really put you in good stead, studying either science or mathematics background. And then the most important thing that I tell people is, what are you going to do before you become an astronaut? Nobody leaves school and becomes an astronaut. You have to do something first. And that's really important. Find something you love doing, work hard at it, be as good as you can be. Don't be put off by, you know, knockbacks along the, on the way, and then you've got the skills to become an astronaut.
Is it as simple as applying for a job as an astronaut in the ESA or a NASA or something, or are you headhunted, are you poached as you would be if you were a spy maybe?
No, it's absolutely as simple as applying. You know, these opportunities don't come along that often, but when you see them, it was in 2008, I saw an online advert. Do you want to become an astronaut? I thought, yes, I do. I was a test pilot at the time, flying helicopters, and I thought, wow, what an opportunity. So I submitted my application along with 8,413 others and thankfully got through.
And you say that we need to work on skills and abilities and talents before we were to apply for the job. What would you say the key ones that, that we should be working on to stand us in the perfect stead to become an astronaut?
So to become an astronaut today, the missions are changing. We're looking at deep space exploration now, which is really exciting. You know, going to the moon, going on to Mars. I spent 6 months in space, which now is very ordinary, but only a few years ago, you know, 6 months was an awfully long time to be in space, and two-week missions were the norm. But whilst I was up there, I was there with two astronauts who were spending a year in space. I think in a few years' time, we're going to look back and say, 6 months, that's a short mission. You know, we're doing three-year missions to Mars now. So what do you need to do a three-year mission? Well, the kind of skills that will put you in good stead is teamwork, communication, international travel, those kind of things. I mean, we're not going to do any of these missions by ourselves. We're going to do them with our international colleagues. Speaking another language will really help as well. So these are the kind of skills that you can pick up along the way that will stand you in good stead to become an astronaut.
And as you said, you spent 6 months on board ISS. Talk me through an average day. You wake up in the morning, what happens?
Average day, wake up 6 o'clock and go and do your hygiene routine. That's just a quick face wash. There's no shower or anything. It's just hot water in a flannel. Brush your teeth, have some breakfast, cup of tea. And the things I would do would be to check my schedule for the day, and I'd check the orbits for the day because I wanted to know where are we flying at. We orbit the Earth 16 times a day. So I'd look at each orbit and think, if I was passing over the UK daytime, think, great, that's a good photo opportunity. Or maybe the Himalayas. That's a good one. I'll look out for that. And I'd set my alarm, several alarms throughout the day, so that I knew which photographs I would want to go and take. And then it would be 7 o'clock. We'd start the working day around Robin around the world, literally talking to Houston and Huntsville in America, then over to Munich in Germany, over to Scuba in Japan, then to Moscow in Russia. We'd talk to these ground stations, find out what the day's activities involve, and then get on with our work. 12-hour day, 7 in the morning, 7 at night, mostly science activities, also maintaining the space station. 2 hours of fitness training each day, sometimes some education programs, some PR, etc. And the day just goes by in a blur. You know, you'll probably get about 40 minutes for a bite to eat at lunchtime. And then before you know it, it's 7 o'clock in the evening. You do another round the world, wrap up with all the ground control stations and get ready for the next day.
Is there no quiet time? Is there no Tim time where you can kind of do stuff that you fancy? I know you're big into your photography. You took your camera up there. How much time do you have to do what you want, to make the most of being in space?
Yeah, so during the day, you can buy yourself some time. If you get some of your jobs done really quickly, then before the next job starts, you might have 5 minutes, 10 minutes. So you've got time to go and take some photographs, maybe have a quick coffee break, tea break, or what have you. But we've always got this backup list of jobs to be done. So even if we get ahead on the timeline, then we go to the backup list and we start working on that. So, you know, we're up there to work hard, and we do work hard. But at the weekends, we do drop the tempo down. Saturday morning, we clean the space station. And then in the afternoon and on Sundays, we do get some time for, you know, calling friends and families and taking photos.
How many people were up in the space station while you were there as well?
I was up there with five others. So we have a normal crew of six on board the space station, is what we try and maintain. But the Soyuz spacecraft takes three people. So you go up as a crew of three and you stay with that crew for 6 months. And then halfway through your mission, three people go down and then you three come and join you.
Now, I can barely go camping with my family for around, I'd say, 3 days before we're at each other's throats. What's it like with five of you being up there for 6 months together? How kind of easy do you have to take it with each other? And what happens if you get a little bit annoyed?
You know, it's really, this question comes up an awful lot, but it's really easy to get on with your crewmates well, because you don't see them for most of the day. Lots of the jobs we do, they're just one-person jobs. You're working in a very solitary environment throughout the day. You're working along your timeline, doing your jobs. So it's actually really nice in the evenings to get together, have a meal and actually chat to each other about what you've been doing. And every Friday, at least, we would come together as a crew of six, usually down in the Russian segment, and we'd all take some of our best food down there and we would just have a really fun Friday night meal. And so if anything, it was nice. We looked forward to the evenings when we could actually chat to each other and get to, you know, and get to find out what everyone else has been doing.
What was the toughest everyday task that was surprisingly hard when you were up there?
I think the surprisingly hard thing is the amount of reading you have to do. We do everything by procedure on board the space station, and you have to follow the procedures carefully. You do not want to make a mistake. You know, you're dealing with scientific experiments that people have worked for years on, and your job is to run it accurately. And you might be jumping, you might be doing 20 different procedures each day, and that's an awful lot of reading. And so you've got to read fast, and you've got to read accurately. And that takes a lot of brain power to be able to read fast and accurately and not make mistakes.
I want to ask a question that might be a bit, like, iffy, all right? But it's fine. It's all about money. Not specifically money, but I've always wondered, when spacemen get paid, are they paid like everyone else, like a salary? Are you paid on completion of the mission? Do you get a bonus for a spacewalk? What goes on?
No, so the European Space Agency astronauts, we are career astronauts. We get paid an ordinary monthly salary, and that's it. And we are, you know, we're recruited to be astronauts for life. So at least hopefully two missions for an astronaut. And then in between times, you're back into the program. You're supporting the human spaceflight program. So it's an ordinary day job for me.
What was the most dangerous thing about everyday life in space? I know we kind of think, I don't know, there must be explosions happening all the time. You're floating around, not really knowing what's going on. Maybe there's aliens, who knows? For you, what was the most dangerous every day when you're up there?
The most dangerous everyday thing is something that we don't really know about, and that's space debris. As in, we're not living in fear on board the space station, but every single moment of every single day, the space station risks being hit by some space debris. And we have protection around the pressurized hulls that will stop anything from 1 centimeter diameter or less. It will stop that from penetrating the hull. And the ground radar stations can track things that are 10 centimetres greater or greater. So there's this black zone between 1 and 10 centimetres where we can't track it by radar, and it's big enough to go straight through the hull. And that's a risk that we live with on board the space station, that you could be hit by something that's going to cause an emergency depressurisation.
I've got some questions from the listeners in just a sec, if that's okay. My last question, because this is a science show, I saw you tweet the other day, and I wrote it down. It says, mind-blowing that all visible matter makes up less than 5% of the universe. Can you just explain that for me for a second? I don't get it.
So we look at the stars and the movement of the stars in galaxies, and we know that there must be more mass out there that's causing these stars to move and the galaxies to move in the manner they are. But we can't see that mass. And so the amount of mass that we can calculate just by visible matter alone makes up just 5%. So 95% of matter or mass of the universe is out there in a different form, and we call that dark energy and dark matter. So dark energy and dark matter combined make up about 95% of the universe, and we really don't know what that is.
What would you, as a spaceman, predict is going to happen with humans' exploration of space within the next 30 years?
So in the next 30 years, I think we're going to go back to the moon, and we're going to use that as a stepping stone to go on to Mars. But what's exciting about the moon is we're going to see, at the moment you've got the International Space Station only 400 kilometres away from Earth. We're going to effectively take that International Space Station, and it's going to become an international habitation station on board on the moon, hopefully the south pole of the moon. That's a really exciting area to go and research. So rather than spending 6 months on the ISS, we'll go and spend 6 months on the lunar surface at a research station. And we'll we'll learn about living on another celestial body, and we'll be able to research all the, you know, this amazing 4 billion years worth of the lunar history that we can learn an awful lot from. And that will help us build the technologies and give us the information to be able to go to Mars and then do the same on Mars, and we'll see ourselves living and working on Mars.
So one day, could the moon in effect be like a service station on the highway from Earth to Mars?
Absolutely, yeah. It could be an absolute service station. In its own right, anyway, it's going to be an incredible research facility. But also as a service station, you know, there's water on the moon. There's the ability to actually create fuel, rocket fuel, from the lunar surface. And the moon's gravity is very easy to escape, much easier than Earth's gravity. So it makes it very much, much easier to land and take off from the lunar surface than it does from the Earth's surface.
Let me just get a few questions in for the Fun Kids listeners. This has been done for a free kids app. It's called Pop Jam. This is from, the names on these people are amazing, by the way. This is from Crazy Cookies 172, who says, what was the most disgusting space food you had to eat?
Most disgusting, it was some peas, mushy peas. They just bland and no texture to them, not very nice at all. I used to just have to add a lot of Tabasco sauce to make them palatable.
Fiery, fiery mushy peas when you're up there. This is from Blobby Goat, who says, why did you take the Lottie doll with you into space?
So the Lottie doll, it was one of the educational programs. We're looking at encouraging things like astronomy trying to reach out to all sorts of different age groups, different genders as well. So the Lottie doll was one of those programs that we're hoping to encourage people to look at in astronomy.
And then finally, this is from Unicorn Summer 1000, who says, what was the best thing you managed to see from the ISS?
The best thing I managed to see is planet Earth every day. Every time you look at Earth from space, it's different. It changes. It's different, either different seasons, different weather systems, different countries, maybe a nighttime. And it would surprise you. I mean, I'd be brushing my teeth one night. I'd just go and pop down and look out the cupola window, and there'd be the most magnificent aurora. And it was just like this secret that nobody else knew about. And I was witnessing it, and it was incredible. Another time you might see thunderstorms by night, or you might have a wonderful day pass and sneak a volcano that's just erupted, and you think, I wonder if anyone on Earth actually knows that volcano is erupting right now, because it's in the middle of Kamchatka and there's nobody there. There's all these kind of secrets that you get to witness when you look down at Earth from space.
Perfect. Tim, thank you so much for coming on the Fun Kids Science Weekly.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
We've actually got a whole series featuring Tim Peake, where he tells us loads more about life as an astronaut. It's called Professor Pulsar's Space Explanation Service, and it's another part of our Deep Space High series on space. You can find it on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. It is time for today's Dangerous Dan, where we look at the most amazingly deadly things in the world. Today, we're headed to Africa, to a place that is so dangerous, it's got kill in its name. The Danakil Desert is in northeastern Ethiopia, and it's got one of the most brutal landscapes in the world. Before I tell you more, I've just realised this desert is called Danakil. My name is Dan, and it wants to kill me? A little bit worrying. Not sure if I should really tell you any more. We'll press on anyway. If you see a picture of the Danakil Desert, you'll notice how sulfuric it looks. Bright oranges, harsh reds everywhere. That's because the whole place is pretty much like an evil oven. It reaches 120 degrees Fahrenheit, and there are loads of active volcanoes around too. In the desert, there are geysers as well, which are sprouting all over the place. Now, these aren't geezers that wear flat caps that go and watch their football and have a bit of banter with your dad. No, these are like mini volcanoes that spit toxic gas out of the top, and cracks run through the desert, and lava, burning hot from the ground, seeps through. Now, many people think the Danakil Desert is hell on earth, but some tribes actually live there. A few of the Afar people habit the desert because they can mine salt from the ground and sell it to make money. You, though, you can't go in. Not alone, anyway. Because the Danakil Desert is so dangerous, you need a trained expert guide to take you through. It is the Fun Kids Science Weekly, and we'll get one of the science questions that you have sent to my page over at funkidslive.com answered by our expert Tom in just a sec. First, it's time to go back into space. God, we've been up and down so many times today. I feel a bit like a seesaw, actually. We need to catch up with Professor Pulsar, though, who is explaining why Mars is so interesting.
Deep Space High, Destination Mars. because lessons are about to begin.
So, we've seen that Mars is a pretty interesting place, and Earthlings are certainly very excited about it. Can anyone tell me why?
Is it because there might be aliens there?
That's right. Although from all the probes and robots that have been sent there, we know that there aren't any three-headed monsters. Well, not that we've seen. I wasn't talking about you, Quark. But yes, there are lots of reasons or clues to think there might be life on Mars. Who can remember any of the clues?
Well, even though it's colder than Earth, it's not too freezing or too hot for humans to survive there. And if humans could, maybe other life could too.
Exactly right. After Earth, Mars is the most Earth-like planet in the solar system. It's in something called the Goldilocks zone. It's close enough to the sun to be able to sustain life, not too hot that any life is just blasted away, and not too cold that there's not enough energy for life forms to survive. Any other clues? Anyone? Okay, I'll give you a clue.
It's water.
That's right. The possibility of running water on Mars is a clue that there might be life. We can see patterns in the rock and dark stripes across the land that suggest there were rivers once. And maybe that water is still there, under the surface of the planet. There's another substance that's been found on the planet.
Chocolate?
Nothing so tasty. Well, not for Earth children. It's methane. Methane is a special gas that can be a sign of organic activity. Quark, that is not a special gas.
So why don't Earthlings send some astronauts up there to have a proper look around?
Funnily enough, that is exactly what's planned. A very exciting project called the Aurora Programme is underway. It will send a special robot to Mars called the ExoMars Rover in a special mission to determine if life exists or ever existed on the red planet. NASA and the European Space Agency are working together on developing robots to probe the planet like never before and provide unprecedented data on the history and composition of this fascinating world.
Awesome! Will any human astronauts go with them?
Not at first. Before humans can set foot on Mars, scientists need to know as much as possible about the red planet. What are the dangers to human explorers? How easy is it to live and work on Mars?
And if there's any other special gases?
They'll be fairly easy to find if any exist. The ExoMars rover mission will be followed by a further mission in the 2020s, which will provide data for a planned human mission in the 2030s.
Wow, a human mission. Astronauts on Mars. Hey, in 2030, I'll be a grown-up. Maybe I could lead the mission.
Yes, and get this, kids. There will be Earth children in school right now who might walk on Mars as part of that mission. Exciting stuff, right?
That's so cool. So what will the ExoMars rover be able to do?
Well, the ExoMars rovers will use the very latest technology. Panoramic cameras with enhanced zoom, infrared spectrometers and organic molecule analyzers to test samples. It'll have more gadgets than stats.
No one has more gadgets than me. Not even on a planet as cool as Mars.
Deep Space High, Destination Mars. Support from the UK Space Agency. Find out more at funkidslive.com/space.
You can also get all our Deep Space High episodes on your phone or your tablet for free. Get to iTunes and the Fun Kids app. So the other day, right, I was in my freezing cold garden booting a ball about with my best mate Steph when I lumped it up and it travelled past some trees and didn't come down the other side. Now, there are two reasons for this, I think. Either I've kicked it really terribly and it's kind of got stuck in some branches, but I can't believe that. My mum always says I'm messy. I don't believe I'm that bad. Or there has been a problem with gravity. You know, science has messed up somehow. And the first thing I wanted to do was ask our Fun Kid Science Weekly expert, Tom, all about it. He's here every week, but I can't. That's the thing. The only questions that he answers are yours, so you need to get them in. And it doesn't matter how silly you think it is. If you've got a question about science, you need to send over to funkidslive.com and our expert Tom will answer it. Today's question, Tom, comes from Eliza. She's 13. And it's possibly my favourite question that you've ever had to answer. Why, when I throw an object up in the air, when I'm sat in a car, why does it come straight back down into my lap? Why does it not fly to the back?
The reason is because of relative motion. So when you're moving in the car, the ball is also moving as well. So although the ball is moving relative to the ground, it's not moving relative to the car. So when you throw it up, it still maintains its speed relative to the ground, and that's the same speed that you're going. So when you throw it up, it lands right back in your lap.
And this is the same across, you know, when we're in aeroplanes and stuff, when we've got people who are travelling really fast in those rocket-powered cars that break all the land speed records. Is there any type of speed that is harmful to us as humans if it doesn't happen, you know, with relative motion kind of thing?
Well, actually, there's no difference between constant speed and no motion at all. From our perspective, you cannot tell the difference. The only thing that we notice is the acceleration, so how you get up to that speed. So if you have really fast acceleration, it feels like there's a force acting on you. If you have no change of speed, then there's no force acting on you.
And what is the force that's acting on us there?
Newton's second law, so it's mass times acceleration. So because we have mass and we're being accelerated...
Is there a name for that? What does it equal, mass times acceleration?
F equals ma.
Oh, force?
Force equals mass times acceleration.
And that's why when you're on a plane, an aeroplane, and you're there, you're taxiing on the runway, that's why you feel it. You know, when they first kick in the engines, the thrusters go and you feel that pull back into the chair. Yeah. You feel that.
Absolutely.
But you don't feel it when you're 37,000 feet in the air and you're going just as fast.
Well, you're going much faster, but it's a constant speed, so you don't feel the force.
Right, let's have a look at the science stories in the news this week. Climate change is making it harder to find Nemo because the oceans are getting hotter and these are killing off anemones, which are plants under the sea. Well, they're actually animals and they look a bit like seaweed, and it's where clownfish lay their eggs. But as they're disappearing, there's nowhere for the eggs to go, which means the clownfish are dying off too. Also, did you see this? An asteroid hurtled past Earth the other day. It was around 26,000 miles away, so no real danger, and we had a global network of telescopes watching it the whole way, but it did give NASA a chance to test out their asteroid warning systems. And finally, new fossil evidence has emerged which shows birds took to the sky years before we thought they did. A specimen of a fossil in China shows that bird skeletons first started changing around 120 million years ago, way before we thought it did, and it means that birds were in the sky just before the dinosaurs went extinct. Right, it's time for us to go to the sky ourselves right now. Way past the sky, actually. We're going up into space again, this time with Technomum.
Technomum's Tech Line, with support from the Institution of Engineering and Technology.
Got a call. Hello, you're through to Techno Mum's Tech Line. What's your techno question?
My friend says there's loads of junk floating about in space. Is that true, and how much is there?
Your friend's right. They estimate that there are over 300,000 pieces of space debris in orbit around the Earth. Now, not everything floating around Earth is junk. In fact, lots of it is very important for our everyday lives. There's hundreds of working satellites that do all sorts of things, like letting us communicate across the world and delivering our television pictures. And don't forget, there's the International Space Station too, a huge scientific laboratory in space. However, what isn't so great is there's a lot of man-made stuff in space that shouldn't be there, particularly in our orbit. It's called space junk. Rubbish that's left over from old satellites, parts of rockets, and loads of fragments from collisions. Some bits of junk are tiny, like paint flakes. Some are much bigger, like nuts and bolts or even empty rocket stages. Scientists track over 19,000 pieces that are over 5 centimetres big. Now, that doesn't sound that big, but when that junk is travelling at over 27,000 kilometres an hour, it can cause devastating damage if it hits anything. Damage can be reduced with Whipple shields, which are a bit like a bumper that's placed a certain distance off the objects that it's protecting, like the space station. If some junk hits the bumper, it absorbs the impact and so protects the station. However, not all parts of a spacecraft can be protected in this way, so things like solar panels and telescopes are subject to constant wear by debris and have to be replaced every now and again. Maybe we need a clever engineer to design a garbage collection spaceship, which can go up there and clean everything up.
Techno Mums Tech Line, with support from the Institution of Engineering and Technology. Find out more at funkislive.com.
Yeah, you can also get loads of Techno Mums adventures and fact files for free on your phone or tablet. Get to the Fun Kids app, get to iTunes and download them wherever you get your podcasts from. Right, that is the end then of another rip-roaring edition of the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Probably the best one that we've ever done. I think so. I've enjoyed it a lot. We've been in space and everything. And I mean, when you've had one of the only British people to ever go into space, it's kind of got to go down as a hit, right? We'll be back next week with more amazing, epic and dangerous things that are out there in the universe. Remember, you can get all of our science series for free on iTunes, over on the Fun Kids website and on the free Fun Kids app. And while you're on the app, stay there because it's one of the best ways that you can hear Fun Kids wherever you are. You can also get us on your DAB digital radio and over at funkidslive.com.
So that was a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
Do whales sneeze?
I'm not sure, but luckily I've got an amazing whale expert I can call on.
We essentially go out onto a boat, we go out to the sea, we look for whales, we see a whale breathing.
Who will take us through her experiments.
And then as the whale takes a breath, the drone is flown through the snot and will deliberately collect as much snot as possible.
And let us know the answer. How does that sound, Guy?
That would be fun.
Join us on the Conversations Curious Kids wherever you get your podcasts.